is in session and will come to order. I just have a brief announcement before we start with our informational meeting this morning. House Bill 2283, which was scheduled for a work session, will not be heard this morning. We're going to hear testimony from several of the stakeholders, so to speak, the Oregon State Bar, the Department of Justice, and the agency representatives. The Oregon State Bar needs some time to reconsider some proposals, and since we can't have we will not have their participation, we'll take it out of work session this morning and reset it when we get a direction as to where this bill is going to go. So anyway, no work session on House Bill 2283, and we can proceed directly into the informational meeting on Oregon constitutional issues. So if those participants would come forward, please. Good morning.
Chairman Ackerman, members of the subcommittee, my name is Susan Leeson. This is Dave Hendricks, and we've been asked to do a brief workshop on Oregon constitutional matters. We will try to keep this short and, we hope, interesting. We'll provide plenty of opportunity for questions, comments, observations. In terms of background history, I've put together a background on the history of the development of the Oregon Constitution for your interest. I won't go into it this morning, but it's been reduced to about 4 pages, and for those of you who, like myself, are history buffs, you might find it interesting to get at some of the background on how we got to where we were in 1857 when it came to drafting the Oregon Constitution. We have handed out a document that has a green cover that contains the Oregon Constitution and the United States Constitution. And if I can indulge you to have that handy, I'm going to ask us to jump back and forth. Pagination may be a little confusing, but we'll try to do our best to get us all on the same page. Constitutional law involves the reading of words, and so I thought it would be useful for us this morning to collectively look at some words together, try to get an idea of how these two documents are different and what's going on under the Oregon Constitution. On page 21 of the handout materials in the Oregon Constitution, section 31 is a provision of the Constitution with which you are all familiar because it is your oath of office. And I thought it was important to start with that oath this morning because you, like I when I was a judge, took an oath to support the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of Oregon. First question that I think we ought to be talking about is, why do we have two constitutions? It's very hard to explain to anybody who has not grown up in the United States why states have constitutions and the national government has a constitution. In other systems of government, there is one constitution with administrative entities, but our states are not administrative entities, as you well know. Some people even call them separate sovereigns. The existence of two constitutions reflects this unique thing called American federalism. When the United States Constitution was debated in 1787, and it's at the back of your materials, the states were already in existence, at least 13 of them. They had exclusive sovereignty. And so the major questions in 1787 is, who or what ought to be represented in this national government we're here to try to create? Is that national government going to destroy the states? How much power should the national government have relative to the states if there is consensus, and there was, that the states are going to continue to operate as substantive units of government? And the third question, of course, was how ought power to be allocated? People have known for thousands of years there are three things governments have to do. They have to make laws, they have to execute laws, and they have to judge laws. But who ought to do that? How ought that to get done? That was a topic of lively debate. The major answers to those three questions were that both the people and the states ought to be represented in the national government. So the United States Senate reflects the representation of states. And, of course, originally, senators were appointed by the state legislatures so that there was an even a stronger tie between the states and the national government. In our wisdom, we now have direct election of senators. Nonetheless, states remain represented in the United States government. With respect to the question, how much power should the national government have, the drafters of the United States Constitution spelled that out in Article 1, which is on page 3. That page 3 is at the back of the materials because it's the Constitution of the United States. The way Article 1 of the United States Constitution starts is very important, especially when we come to comparing it with Article 4 of the Oregon Constitution. Article 1, Section 1 says, all legislative powers herein granted. In other words, the United States Congress cannot legislate on any subject whatsoever. The United States Congress can legislate only on those matters authorized by this Constitution. Article 1, Section 8, which is on page 4 of that document, then lays out what those powers are, what the realm of authority is of the United States Congress. That's the way the system worked until the Civil War. The 14th Amendment made a substantial alteration in that view of very limited legislative powers. But the argument in 1787 was that legislative power has to be spelled out because that's the biggest power. That has the potentially greatest danger to infringe on the liberties of human beings. So we got to spell it out. And we state representatives at the convention, jealous of our powers, really want to make sure we constrain what that national government can do. So they spelled out legislative powers in Article 1. The other thing they did was to separate the powers. They knew you got to make laws, you got to execute laws, you got to judge laws. The great invention of 1787 was to put those three powers in three different departments. In England, it hadn't been that way. The judiciary, the House of Lords, is in the legislative. But 1787, one of the great contributions to the study of politics, supposedly, was creation of three independent branches and especially an independent judiciary. So those were concerns in the 18th century. Oregon, of course, doesn't come into the Union until the 19th century. One of the afterthoughts of the United States Constitutional Convention was, what about a Bill of Rights? James Madison agreed to draft a bill as a political concession for ratification. So when we look at the United States Constitution, we see a document that provides for three powers, explicitly lays out what legislatures can do, and is, as if you will, an afterthought. That's on page 9 of your materials, appends a Bill of Rights. Now let's jump to the 19th century and what was going on in Oregon. By 1857, when the Oregon Constitutional Convention convened, the concerns were very different than they had been in 1857. The convention, by the way, was made up of 60 men, 33 farmers, 18 lawyers, but as you're experiencing, no doubt, here, you only have a few lawyers, but boy, can they talk a lot. Same thing happened at the Constitutional Convention. When you look at who spoke the most, it was the lawyers. The original document had 175 sections. 172 of those were taken from other states' constitutions. Nothing creative here. Indiana provided most of the material, but Maine and Iowa also contributed. Why did they pick those states? Just happened there were people at the convention from there who had those laws with them. Said, we have some history, seems to work there, maybe it'll work here. The only part of the original Constitution that was drafted with any creativity at all was the judicial branch. And of course that then got amended in 1910 by initiative. But what we took from other states has lasted quite well. All right, what's taken for granted in 1857? Let's now look at the Constitution of the State of Oregon, Article 1, which is on page 3 of the materials. Look how our Constitution starts. It starts with a Bill of Rights. Every state constitution, with the exception of the state of New York, reflects that way of thinking. This is the first unit of big government that's going to be created, so let's first lay out what the rights of the people are. A very conventional way of drafting constitutions. That was done well before the United States Constitution was enacted, of course. But notice that by the 19th century, we still thought it was important to lay out first what are the rights of the people that we seek to protect in the creation of this government. So Article 1 is not an amendment. Article 1 is the Bill of Rights, and that was the starting point. Notice what it says. We declare that all men, when they form a social compact, are equal in right. This is classic what's called social contract theory. We create government by agreement. It's a deal. It's a contract. There are a number of provisions in the Oregon Bill of Rights that don't exist in the United States Constitution. Let's just take a look at a couple of those, and we'll come back and examine some of the interpretive problems they've created for us. Article 1, Section 10 on page 3. We don't find anything equivalent to this in the United States Constitution. It says, no court shall be secret, but justice shall be administered openly and without purchase, completely and without delay, and every man shall have a remedy by due course of law for injury done to him in his person, property, or reputation. What in the world does that mean? Where do we go to try to understand it? We can't go to the United States Constitution and interpretations because it isn't there. On the next page, take a look at Article 1, Section 20. Equality of privileges and immunities of citizens. No law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which, upon the same terms, shall not equally belong to all citizens. What in the world does that mean? We can't just jump to the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution to learn what it means, because this was written in 1857. 14th Amendment wasn't adopted until 1864. It addressed a Civil War concern. Equal privileges and immunities provision was thinking in the 19th century that was there well before concerns about equal protection stemming from the Civil War. So it's important in understanding Oregon's Bill of Rights to know not only are they not just a series of amendments, afterthoughts, they are the core, they are our starting point, and they contain provisions that the United States Constitution does not contain. It was also taken for granted in 1857 that Oregon would have an independent judiciary. The fight over whether the judiciary ought to be housed in the legislature or even be a subsection of the executive branch, that fight was over, and nobody even fought to have the fight come up again. It was settled. We're going to have an independent judiciary. Another thing that was a given is reflected on page 14 of the Oregon Constitution. In Article 4, it lays out the legislative department. Actually, the wording starts on page 15. I pointed out to you how in the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 1 starts all legislative power herein granted. You can only do what we tell you you can do. Look at your authority as legislators in the state of Oregon. The legislative power of the state. As though we already know what it is, or you can decide what it is. Except for the initiative and referendum powers reserved to the people is vested in a legislative assembly. So there's not that equivalent laying out of what you can do, what your powers are, as is in the United States Constitution. You have plenary legislative powers. And there was no debate about what that meant. So, hey, we all know what legislative powers are. What were the major issues then in 1857, if those big questions had been answered? Three concerns. Strict regulation of corporations. When you read this document, you just see that 19th century preoccupation with regulating corporations. Also a preoccupation with keeping state government small. There's been a lot written about the Oregon Constitutional Convention. And the one common theme is we want small government. And perhaps as a subset of that, a third major concern at the time was, and we want frugal government. So they refused to spend any money to have a reporter of the convention. They refused to pay public officials high salaries. In fact, what their debates focused on is how little can we pay them and still get good people. And very strict debt limits throughout the document on what the states can do. So, very different concerns in 1857 than had been present at the adoption of the United States Constitution. All right, what's changed the relationship? What's really affected how we work together? The United States Constitution in Article 6 says, and that's on page 8 of the United States Constitution, it says, this Constitution and all laws of the United States made pursuant thereof and so on and so on shall be the supreme law of the land. A suggestion that in some instances federal legislation, national legislation, is going to trump state legislation. Very controversial topic. It wasn't until the 14th Amendment after 1866, that was finally adopted in 1868, is the adoption of the 14th Amendment that has affected a huge change in the balance of power between the national government and the state government. And Congress's enforcement powers under the 14th Amendment are what have really altered matters. All right, a couple of other things about the Oregon Constitution compared to the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution clearly contains separation of powers. It says Article 1, the legislative power. Article 2, the executive power. Article 3, the judicial power. But it doesn't say anything about the relationship of those branches to one another. And so we have to look to a lot of history and works like the Federalist Papers to explain why they organized them as they did. But take a look at Article 3, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution, which is on page 13. That article is called the Distribution of Powers. We have wording in our state constitution about what the relationship of the branches will be. Section 1, the powers of the government shall be divided into three separate departments, the legislative, the executive, including the administrative. And they may have put in that administrative branch in order to address their concerns about frugality and small government, by the way, and the judicial. And no person charged with official duties under one of these departments shall exercise any of the functions of another except as in this Constitution expressly provided. So in 1857, the drafters of our Constitution took separation of powers very, very seriously. And they said, you're not to do anything that may belong to another branch unless this Constitution explicitly tells you you can do so. It's much more liquid and fluid in the United States Constitution. So this is what some people have called the parchment barriers against branches of government encroaching upon one another. The dynamics of the United States Constitution apparently are supposed to achieve the same thing without actually having said it. Okay. That's a brief overview of the kinds of concerns, some major ways in which our two constitutions are different. And now Dave's going to talk with us about executive and legislative powers, some assumptions about judicial powers, and delegation of powers under the Oregon Constitution.
Thank you, Sue. Dave Hendricks, Acting Legislative Counsel. That was a great start. Thank you. Kind of gets us set up for the bigger picture anyway, and I'll work down a little bit to maybe a little more of the details. One of the great things about the way state constitutions were written, as Justice Leeson has mentioned, is that they took a hugely different approach to the whole issue of defining what the legislative power was. The consequence of the way the U.S. Constitution phrased it in terms of only those powers as expressly provided in the Constitution were literally about 150 years of litigation in deciding what it was that Congress had the power to do, an issue that really wasn't really decided, hasn't really been decided yet today. There's still debates about the ability of Congress to pass laws that control the states. And, of course, it became most crucial in 1860 with the Civil War, when states' rights was one of the big issues that were fought out. We don't have that issue underneath the Oregon Constitution. The issue we're left with is the same issue that Congress has in the Constitution with respect to what are those powers that are laid out for the three different branches of government, and what does it mean to say that the judicial power of the state is vested in the Supreme Court, or that the legislative power is vested in the legislature, in the state legislature in this case. One of the great cases that were initially decided underneath the U.S. Constitution directly addressed what the power of the judiciary was. And that was something of an open question at the very beginning, because there's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that really tells you flat out the Supreme Court is the final interpreter of the United States Constitution. It's not there. It was implicit in many of the discussions that led up to the adoption of Article 3, but it isn't spelled out in any clear fashion. And almost every law school student going into law school, and they go to constitutional law class, and probably the first case they always have to read is Marbury versus Madison, in which the principle is laid down, the Supreme Court is the final person to decide what the Constitution means. I would argue that is probably the most significant power of the courts, of the judicial branch. You remember the presentation that was you had before you about interpretation, statutory interpretation, and one of the things that was mentioned there was about 75% of what the Oregon Court of Appeals does, and I suspect the Supreme Court as well, is interpret statutes that you have passed. And their role there is, the court's role there are extremely narrow. They're just trying to figure out what it is that you, the legislature, meant when you wrote that statute. That is their role in doing that. Now, that's not a significant role when you think about it. It's just trying to figure out what it is that you did. It's not a huge power, it seems to me. And if they get it wrong, you have all the power in the world to go back and clarify that statute and say, no, that's not what we meant. We meant this. And so really, it's really only the power to force the legislature to clarify what it is they intended to say in the law in the first instance. Now, you take that and compare it to a case in which someone has challenged a statute based on constitutionality. Once the Supreme Court has said, this law, we determined it to be unconstitutional, at that point, the only way to remedy that is, of course, to go back and amend the Constitution. That is the real power of the judicial branch, and that was what was decided in Marbury v. Madison, and was implicitly included, I think, in all those state constitutions that were adopted thereafter that. When they said, this is the judicial power, that is one of the things that the courts effectively got with that grant of power. So, you go from that and you say, okay, so the courts are the ones who are going to decide what the Constitution means. They are going to look at these cases as they come forward, and they're going to decide, and there's always interesting questions, and we get them every now and then, too. How does the court enforce that? I'm not going to try to get into that. It's a difficult question. It's one of the fundamental questions about various powers. What if the executive branch says, I don't care what the court says about the Constitution, we're going to do something. And we've always managed to avoid that Constitution. And it's one of the great things about the system is that the other branches, both the legislative and the executive, we have never gotten to that point where I think we've ever had to face the question about what if one of the two branches just said, I don't like what the court says, we're not going to go there. Probably the closest we ever came to it was during the Depression.
In the school desegregation
cases. In the school desegregation case is a good example, too. That during the Depression, we had the problem, not the problem, there was a long string of cases in which there were questions about the Supreme Court did a series of cases in which they struck down a whole lot of New Deal legislation, and Franklin Roosevelt's suggestion was, well, let's just put a couple more justices on and we'll get the people in there who believe the way I do. I think even the greatest supporters of FDR would argue that that was the one time where he probably overstepped, the place where he should have gone, because no matter what you think about the decisions of the Supreme Court or whether or not you believe it or not, it is so fundamental to the way the system works that the other two branches recognize that role, that if you decide to shift away from that, the checks and balances system really falls apart. If you look at what's going on in the new countries that are being created out of the former Soviet bloc, if you look at the problems they have right now, one of the greatest ones they have is that they don't have this clear power, this recognition that the judiciary gets to be the one who decides what their new constitutions mean. In many of those states, the executive branch has decided we have as much power as the judiciary to say that. And it isn't working, and it isn't going to work, because If one body has the ability to determine what the Constitution means, at that point, there are no limits on that particular branch's powers. There are no limits. There are no checks. There are no balances. I get to decide whether or not I can do this or not. Big problems. Okay, so working down from that a little bit, since that's way up high, we're going to talk a little bit about the interrelation between the branches, because that's always of great interest. I would say the power that the legislature has, the real power that they have, is twofold. Obviously, you can control basically anything the executive branch does. The executive branch executes the laws. You make the laws. If you don't like what the executive branch is doing, you have the ability to go in and pass a law to say change it. Now, within that simple statement, there are, of course, the other checks and balances that come into play. A, you're going to have to get a constitutional majority vote in both chambers in order to pass this law. B, you're going to have to get it passed to governor who has the ability to veto that law. But given those restraints on your ability, you still have the ability to basically tell the executive branch what it is they have to do, and assuming you can get through those. And there's also, of course, referral measures which avoid the veto, allow you to go directly to the people with proposals for changing the way the executive is doing things. So within that relationship, we usually don't get a lot of big issues about the relative power, the executive power versus the legislative power. The one that I get the most questions about usually is about things that executive branches do that clearly look legislative. Rulemaking. You look at rulemaking, you say, hey, we're the ones who are supposed to be making the laws. Why is it that this agency is passing these rules that look clearly legislative to us and is something more within our realm of responsibility? And the answer to that is basically that it's almost impossible to pass any law telling an agency to do something that does not require them to make some legislative decisions about how they're going to do it. And at one point back in the 30s, there were some very strict restrictions on whether or not on rulemaking by agencies, that the legislature had to provide standards. They had to tell them basically, you know, what it, give them something to work from and not just go out and adopt laws. Almost all of those restrictions have disappeared over time. Right now, we have what's called the Administrative Procedures Act, which establishes the procedure for hearings and other things you have to do for an executive branch agency to engage in this legislative function. If they go through those processes, you're not going to be able to challenge the executive branch for engaging in a legislative function. And the same thing is true for what the executive branch does in the way of judicial functions. As you know, almost all executive branch agencies do hearings of some sort when someone says, gee, I should have gotten this license and you didn't give it to me. And the agency says, well, we'll provide you with a hearing, which looks kind of like a little mini trial, and that's what it is. It's usually something called a contested case hearing, or it's basic due process type hearing. And there have been cases that have challenged that and said, isn't that the executive branch exercising judicial functions, and how can they do that? And the courts have pretty much uniformly said on that, no, it's not really incidental exercise of the judicial function in the performance of your executive duties is not going to be considered an exercise of a judicial branch function. And, of course, all of those have appeals to the courts after the decision is made. There might be some other issue on that if there was not that ability to get to the courts after that decision was made. I think we've kind of already pretty much covered judicial versus executive branch, or judicial versus legislative branch. The issues there that at least in to my mind are significant is that the judicial branch, when it exercises its authority to interpret the Constitution and do those things, the legislative response on those It might be better to work into the interpretive aspect here, because I think that's where the idea of the court is the reactive branch. The idea as the court reacting to what comes before them as the legislature puts forth laws and attorneys start bringing up issues before them they haven't heard before. So
I guess the way I think about it is you are the proactive branch. You identify issues of public policy, you wade into the fray, and you set public policy. And you don't have to wait for anybody to sue anybody or anything else. You can legislate on anything within the province of the legislative branch. The courts are called reactive branches. And as much as we want to talk about judicial activism, I'm talking about something different. Courts can't do anything until there's a case in controversy, until parties decide to bring an issue before them. Courts can't just step in and offer advisory opinions or declare their views on constitutional or statutory matters. They exercise their power exclusively in the resolution of particular cases. And that has its strengths and weaknesses as a method of interpreting statutes and constitutions, because cases always involve a very discrete set of facts. And it's very tough as a judge sometimes to know that there is much more going on in the periphery, but you're limited to this case and controversy, this record, this set of facts.
Yeah. The one of the things that always, so as a drafter here in this building, and it's also for the average practitioner, I think, as well, is you're always waiting for that decision from the Supreme Court that's going to lay out this nice, clear roadmap on this issue and say, oh, that's how you do that, and they're going to go bang, 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 bang. You don't get many of those decisions.
Very few of those decisions. The other thing is that courts respond to the theories that the parties put in front of them. Rarely will you see the court, in fact, I never saw it happen in the 10 or 12 years I did the work, reach out and say, hey, there's a better way to think about this problem, let's do it this way. It's, here are the arguments that have been presented by the parties, here are the statutory and or constitutional basis on which that argument has been presented. We resolve it based on the way the case is pitched, if you will. There's one exception to that rule. On page 14 of the Bill of Rights, you'll see a provision, and this is just as an example, about the right to bail, Article 1, Section 14. And there was a case that came to the court, and it said, my rights under Article 1, Section 14 have been violated. I'm sorry, I said page 14, and I didn't mean that. I meant page 4 of the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, it's Section 14. Offenses except murder and treason shall be bailable by sufficient sureties. So if somebody brings a case and says, my rights have been violated under Article 1, Section 14, the one time the courts will say, we may not need to go there, is if there is a statute that affords the relief that the party is looking for. So in a very interesting case, it turns out you had a statute, ORS 135-285 sub 2, that provided the complete relief that this party was entitled to receive. And that whenever the court discovers that there is a statute that does the job and avoids having to interpret the Constitution, they will take the statutory route out even if the parties haven't argued it. But with that exception, courts respond to the parties and the theories that parties present to them. Now, parties know what the methodology is for interpreting the Constitution and statutes and initiatives. And I know that you've already had a presentation on that. We can go over a little bit more. Parties know what that methodology is, and so they will pitch their arguments in terms of that methodology. But deciding which constitutional provision may be at issue, that's their choice.
Yeah, and the only thing I would say on that, add to that, is that on occasion you will see situations where the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, will go back and they will not usually come up, they will not come up with a new theory. They won't say, gee, shouldn't you be suing so-and-so or something like that. They're not going to do that. But what they might very well do is say, there's an issue here that's raised by these facts that you brought to us, a legal issue that may have been, you have not given much attention to, or maybe not even mentioned at all, but we think is very significant to the decision of this case, and they will ask the parties to brief them.
Rebrief it.
At one time, there was a lot of back when I started practicing law, there was a lot of debate about, or concern about, though the courts would decide a case on a theory that had not been briefed to the court. And I think the court got that message pretty loud and clear, and almost always now, if it's going to be, if they're looking at deciding it on some theory other than the theory that's been briefed, they go back to the party and ask them to brief them, and that happens every now and then.
Every now and then, but it's pretty
not
rare.
Not very often. It's pretty rare. Right. It is.
Okay, so let's talk about how courts go about interpreting the Constitution. As I just mentioned, if there is a statutory ground that gives the party the relief to which that person is entitled, and the party has only argued a constitutional ground, the court will nonetheless resolve the case on the statutory ground. Courts, unlike perhaps some advocates of the initiative, really respect the document. Don't tinker with it. Don't interpret it. Leave it alone if there's a way to avoid it. There's almost a sacred quality to a constitution. So if you can resolve a case based on a statute, do so. If, however, you are required, the case makes it inevitable that you must interpret the Constitution, the methodology that the court has adopted is to say our goal is to figure out what did the drafters intend, not what do we think is a nice answer or what might be a better way of thinking about this problem, but, again, looking at this as a politically sacred text, what did its creators intend? The starting place is always the words they used. Lawyers are wordsmiths, and so they look at words, their arrangement in a sentence, their definitions, and their meanings with almost obsessive interest. So look at the specific wording. Look at its context. What words surround the words that are in controversy? Has the court already interpreted this provision, not answering this question, but in a way that is helpful to answering this question? I ran into a couple of cases when I was on the Supreme Court where, yes, the court had weighed in on the meaning of a provision of the Oregon Constitution, and it had said opposite things over the course of the years. So have to acknowledge those conflicts when they exist. And then if we still can't figure out what does the Constitution mean, what does it require, look to the historical circumstances that led to its creation. And that's a somewhat problematic effort, just as it is with the United States Constitution. So always the focus is on the words, the text in context. Now, if the constitutional provision has been adopted by initiative, the inquiry is only a little bit different, but as you can imagine, infinitely more fascinating in the detail. There, the goal is, what did the voters intend? Counsel, try not to giggle. What did the voters intend? We all have this problem, but that's our starting point, or our goal is to get to the intent of the voters. Again, looking at the text and the wording of the ballot measure. That can include related ballot measures if that kind of points towards an intent. The history of the provision yields great debate among judges about what's relevant history. Mm-hmm. Voter pamphlet statements? What about TV ads? What about editorial endorsements? What about other possibilities, flyers that were distributed and so on? And get into a lot of argument about how we figure out what the intent of the voters was in interpreting an initiative. But that's the drill. Okay, now, Dave wants to talk about some procedures associated with that and then maybe some examples of controversies that have come up.
And I would also just add to what Justice Leeson was saying. I think even in 1857, looking at the Constitution then, we always get nervous in our office when someone says, we're looking to determine what the drafters intended. So I draft a lot of things. What I intend really doesn't make much difference. In looking at 1857 and looking at the Constitutional Convention and looking at the document they produced, the courts kind of used this little bit of quite a bit of fiction. Well, I think there's a lot of fiction involved in legislative interpretation anyway. That the people who voted on those measures were perhaps reading the newspaper reports of what the Constitutional Convention was doing, et cetera, and hence would use that in making decisions about how to vote. But I think even in 1857, what we're looking at is the intent of those people who voted in 18. I mean, what do you think? Is it because the drafters
you know, the dilemma is they had no voice except an up or down vote on the Constitution.
Correct.
And when we're looking at a specific provision. But you're right, it is a fiction, and I think the reason we kind of pierce that fiction veil is to get at the reality. So-and-so constitutional delegate is the one who spoke to the
correct.
To the
correct.
Particular matter.
And if you've ever done any, I doubt if you, to maybe some of the, but it's a fascinating process when you do get a question and you have to look at the materials available for 1857. And we haven't talked too much about the evolution from the court about how they look at determining the meaning of the Constitution, a thing that's a huge controversy both for the federal and the state constitution. One of the interesting things that's happened with the court, and you may remember my court presentation talking about some of the cases that have come down where they have gone back to look at what were causes of actions you could sue for in 1857. Now, that historical analysis of going back and really looking hard at what the intent was in 1857 is a different emphasis than the court has used in the past. They had not done, they did not used to do quite so much reference back to the historical situation surrounding the adoption of the Constitution. One of the jokes that kind of came out back when those cases came down was is that, well, we get rid of a lot of these texts and things we have now. What we really need to do is beef up the law library with a lot of materials from 1857, historical stuff that is very hard to find, and it's very hard to find much to help you interpreting what the Constitution, what they intended in 1857. The standard text is a book called Carey, who in the 1920s wrote, basically gathered up in a book, a history of the Oregon Constitution, the process, and primarily when you leaf through, it's a lot of the newspaper, the Oregonian, and one of the other papers that. And you almost never find anything on the specific one you're looking for, because they were talking about things like corporations. I mean, they really were afraid of corporations and the idea of limited liability for stock issuance, et cetera. They spent a lot of time on that and on other issues that are not terribly relevant anymore. If you want to find something on Article 1, Section 10, you probably won't find anything. They picked it up from Indiana and said, looks good to us, and they never... There was no discussions of some of these very fundamental rights that are, for instance, in the Bill of Rights. So it's a challenging exercise always, and it's one of the reasons why the courts rely so much on the textual analysis, because they probably aren't going to find a lot. They have to look at a lot of different states, at what they had been saying this constitutional provision meant. And it's also subject to the possibility that at a later date someone will come up with better historical evidence. I mean, one of the interesting debates on free speech has been our Constitution has been interpreted to provide greater protections for free speech than is provided by the U.S. Constitution. And that was done on a historical analysis, looking at how people felt about free speech in 1857. There are some people who want to come back now and argue, well, we found better historical evidence with respect to this. You ought to change your mind about what it means.
Let me make one observation there. Compare Article 1, Section 8, Oregon's Free Speech Clause, with the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution, First Amendment. The wording is very different. And Article 1, Section 8 says, no law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatever. That wording is not present in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. And that leads to the kind of interpretive struggle that frequently can go on.
Yeah, one of the interesting things is that for all these states, other than the original 13, who all had various constitutions of various sorts at the time they came into the Union, is all these states that came along, like Oregon later, and they looked at, like, Indiana and said, this looks good to us, you know, let's go ahead and use this. Well, one of the significant aspects of that is that the language is so radically different than the U.S. constitution. Why, if you were going to adopt the state constitution and you really intended it to mean the same thing as the First Amendment, would you adopt language that is so different than the U.S. Constitution's language? And frankly, this whole aspect of it is a fairly new development as well, dating from the 60s and 70s, and much to the credit of Professor Hans Lindy and a former justice of the court, who wrote a very influential article saying, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, courts would say they would get an equal protection argument or a First Amendment argument, and they would immediately go to the federal cases interpreting the U.S. Constitution. And the question was, why would you not look at your own Constitution first, since its language is so radically different and probably may very well had an entirely different meaning in 1857 than what they thought they were getting in 1787 with the adoption of the U.S. Constitution. And that's been a fairly recent development, this focus on, well, let's look to the Oregon Constitution first. And this is kind of part of gets a little bit into the supremacy argument. The pecking order here is U.S. Constitution controls everything down from there. If anything that happens down below, down to water district, trying to do something, if it violates the U.S. Constitution, can't do it. You know, and the U.S. Supreme Court is going to tell us that, whether or not it does or not. The next level is federal law. Federal statutes beat everything down below them, can't beat the U.S. Constitution, but everything below. And then the more interesting aspect for me always is, and we do get it every now and then, is occasionally there'll be a rule that comes along that actually conflicts maybe with the Oregon Constitution. I talked a little bit about delegation there at the state level. Same rules apply at the federal. Federal rules beat the Oregon Constitution if they're within the scope and intent of the legislation, federal legislation. That's an interesting issue. It might have been one we were dealing with on the assisted suicide one if the assisted suicide thing was a constitutional provision instead of statutory. I think it would have been interesting because it would have had a rule conflicting with with a constitutional provision. And then, of course, comes the state standards of the Oregon Constitution and statutes below that. And rules, et cetera, the same rule. But there is that pecking order, and you look at it to determine, you know, any single one of them at the lower levels could have all sorts of problems with everything up above them. At the state statutory level, the only thing we worry about, of course, is state constitution, federal rules, federal statutes, U.S. Constitution. I'm going to talk a little bit about amending the Constitution, obviously always of interest, and much interest here in the last 10 years or 15 years, again, evolving under the Constitution. And again, I would reiterate what Justice Leeson had said. Most of these things may look like they're new things. They're things that, gee, you're suddenly interpreting the Constitution different than you used to. But the bottom line is that so many of the questions that lead to these changes are questions that were never asked before. Some of these constitutional provisions, if you go through and look at the cases interpreting them, there aren't any. If you go back and look at Article 1, Section 10 on the right to remedy, there's almost nothing out there up until very recently where anybody's looked at them and said, well, what does this mean? What was intended? What is the effect on that, on this proposed law or this? So anyway, that has also happened in the rules relating to amending the Constitution. And the one that, of course, has really come to fore in the last few years is amendments versus revisions of the Constitution. And it's come up primarily because of the initiative. And the question was, and there's a very interesting series of cases on this. The big one is the one called Armada, where they looked at the Victims' Rights Initiative that was passed in the 1990s, which had a laundry list of things that it did. I mean, it affected everything from how many people it took to get a vote for a murder conviction to the right to search and seizure, the right against self-incrimination. There was just a whole series of things that was passed out as a constitutional amendment that covered a whole lot of different things. And the Supreme Court, for the first time, was asked to look at that and say, what does the language in Article 4, Section 1, where it talks about amending the Constitution, what does it mean? And the conclusion they reached was that an amendment, then an amendment, and the test they came up with, and this is, again, an evolving test. We're going to may find out more from, for instance, the case they currently have on civil forfeiture, the measure that's up before the Supreme Court now on the same challenge. Each case that comes from the Supreme Court adds a little bit to it. But the test they're using now pretty much is, would a voter looking at this proposed constitutional amendment, could they, in fact, look at some piece of it and say, you know, I'd vote differently on that one than I would on this one, but I'm willing to vote for the whole package because overall I'm happy, even though there are pieces of it, amendments that I don't like. And that's kind of the test they've come up with.
But that's, just to clarify, that's been under Article 17, not under Article 4.
Well,
the Armada decision was two or more amendments shall be submitted in a matter of the voters shall be submitted so that each amendment is voted on separately. And so the problem in Armada is, do we have one or multiple amendments?
And then what happened, though, what was interesting on the Armada, with the Victim Rights Initiative was, it came back to this body after it was held to be unconstitutional because amending more than one section. And the court and this body took it up and said, well, obviously the solution is send it back out in pieces. Break it down into each, so that each book piece was a true amendment, single amendment to the Constitution. And they sent out, nine separate measures,
mm-hmm.
and kind of validating what the Supreme Court said, three or four of them didn't make it when they were voted on a separate basis. Three or four of them didn't make it. And that was kind of the lesson there, that when people were looking at individual amendments, they might vote differently than if they were looking at the whole package. And it's very similar to the issues that we have in this body with bills that are treated as being log rolling. You know, log rolling is that old concept of, we'll take this bill and I know you don't like what's in it, but I'll take something you like and we'll put that in and we'll put some other stuff in, and pretty soon we'll have a package everybody can vote on, even though they may really hate Section 37. And it's the same thing. This is a constitutional principle built in now that, on the initiative anyway, they're going to have to come down to a single amendment. And it's also the reason why we have ballot measure 37 right now. Measure 37, which is a statutory provision, of course, had its was initiated by ballot measure 7, which was a constitutional amendment and was struck down as being a revision, you know, more than one amendment, rather than the single amendment that was required. Now, for the legislature, the issue is slightly different. The legislature does have the ability to do a revision. You just have to get a two-thirds vote to send it out. So for our office, the issue always is, well, is it an amendment? Is it a revision? If it's an amendment, you can just pass it along to the people with a simple majority vote. If it's a revision, i.e. more than one amendment, it's going to have to get the supermajority. And that's sometimes a tough call. It's sometimes a very tough call to decide what exactly it means to say, are there two pieces of this that someone might vote differently on if they were looking at them? And it sounds easy to state that test. It's a lot harder to apply.
If we had time, we were going to give some examples of interpretive controversies, but I see eyes glazing over and time running. So let's see if there are any questions or curiosities you have that we might be helpful on. Otherwise, we're going to let you move on with your important day.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Justice Leeson, I wanted to go back to something you were talking about before, which is how you, when you're in the judicial process, trying to apply the voter-initiated changes, particularly constitutional changes. And one of the things that I've seen happens in the campaigns, typically in opposition to a proposed constitutional change, will be to present all the horribles that could happen, the ways it could be interpreted or misapplied or maybe applied according to its terms, to try and build the worst case sort of scenario. And to what extent when a measure then does pass, to what extent are the horribles that have been painted by the opponents taken into account by the court in interpreting what the measure means, because it, and I guess the corollary question is, are the opponents unwittingly creating something in the nature of legislative or measure history when they paint with a broad brush the things that might come to pass?
Representative McPherson, all I can do is give you one person's thought on that, because these are the kinds of things that in a collegial court you have debate on. But under the methodology, we look at the text in its context, including related ballot measures. And the question is, what did the voters intend? So I would argue that what constitutes the relevant history is the history in favor of the measure. If it was approved, that's what the voters must have intended. Now, in fact, when I had a case, I didn't even look at the arguments in opposition because the measure was passed. So I say, okay, the opponents lost. So they're not helping me much. But what I have to do is look at the text and the context. And if the list of horribles emerges based on my own analysis, then it's the list of horribles in terms of what the words actually provide for. But I can't speak for the court, wouldn't presume to speak for the court. I may have former colleagues who would disagree with that observation. How about you, Dave?
I think it's a valid position you're going to take, that you look at the ones that said here's what it is going to do, rather than the ones that are making arguments about things that, horrible things that might happen. But then, you know, it seems so rare that you don't get some response to that list anyway, where the proponents say, oh, no, it doesn't. It doesn't do that. In which case, you end up kind of back where you started from, does it or doesn't it, and looking at the text and deciding whether, in fact, it does or not. And I think in those cases, arguments, again, will probably come down to the language. The problem is that so many of them are so vague that it's hard to tell. You're trying to figure out what they did. Not, you know, it's not peripheral things. It's very fundamental things on a lot of them about what an issue accomplished when the voters pass that particular measure.
Further questions, Representative Garrard?
Just curious as to why all tax measures must originate in the House?
The answer comes from political theory, and it's that is the body closest to the people. The Senate represents geographic areas, counties in the states, or states in the national government. Money hurts, comes out of my wallet, so I want that unit of government closest to my wallet to initiate and make the decision.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Worth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about the rulemaking that you were speaking of in the 30s. Apparently, there were the restrictions imposed by the legislature on the rulemaking process, and you mentioned that they almost entirely have been eliminated over time. Was there at any point in time when they were, a block of them or a group of them were eliminated for some reason, some particular reason, and then also were they all adopted at once, or were they adopted kind of piecemeal over time? And I'm interested in just how differently things were with those restrictions, how we would operate today if we had those restrictions.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Worth, what I was referring to was the fact that at one time the courts took the position that if the legislature was going to delegate rulemaking authority to an agency, that they would put certain requirements on, saying, you know, at that point they had a strong view of the legislature as being the one who exercised the legislative authority, and that administrative agencies had very limited powers in that area. And what they came to over time came to say was, we're not going to put such limitations on the legislature. If they want to tell an agency, go forth and do good in an area, the legislature can do that. And one of my classic examples is always the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act. If you go and look at what guidance there is in those statutes about what those agencies do, there's very little. They have a general directive to go forth and do these things. And as long as they use procedures that ensure public input, public hearings, et cetera, the courts uphold those now. They tend not to be subject to challenge simply because, well, they're exercising legislative authority. The issue I've had to deal with over the years has always been the feeling that I've been involved in numerous work groups over the years where people have come in and argued that the legislature were basically dodging its responsibility by not making these decisions, by letting the agencies make the unpopular ones and then refusing to come back and look at what the agency had done, which is why we had some of these ballot measures over the years that would have allowed, for instance, the last one was one that would have allowed you to get a petition out and have the force the legislature basically to look at a rule adopted by
right.
the agency.
Can I have a follow-up question?
Yes, you may.
I'm interested in the intent of, you know, trying to interpret the intent of the voters in passing initiatives. Can you give me a glimpse of what few of them the most difficult are? What few you are so glad you never had to interpret?
Representative Worth, I appeared at the Supreme Court the day before re-argument in Armada versus Kitzhaber, and so that was an interesting exercise for me, trying to figure out what the voters had intended in that huge criminal. The first word that comes to mind is revision, but of course that's answer begging the question. And there were a couple of issues there. First, what is the appropriate constitutional provision to analyze? And there, counsel came up with a very creative argument. So the court basically has ignored Article 17, which tells us what can be done by initiative and that the voters have to vote on separate amendments separately. The court had not construed that provision before. It had never been put in the court's lap before. Parties had always argued on some other constitutional theory. So you run into the problem of which constitutional provision is providing the framework for the analysis. Then when we get to what did the voters intend, the difficulties are poor drafting. I'll just be blunt about that. Drafting that is not precise or careful, that we rarely see come out of the legislature, because there is a process in the legislature for careful drafting and the debate that goes back and forth to sharpen and focus. It doesn't happen with initiatives. That's compounded by the way the arguments in support are phrased in the voter's pamphlet, because those are relevant history or consideration for the courts to look at. So because the initiative process is so completely unrestrained in its procedure, that creates interpretive problems of immense magnitude for the courts.
Just to add to that, the only thing I'd add is this, is that constitutional language is the hardest language to draft. Every single word is freighted. If you look at the U.S. Constitution and look at some of these sections, if you look at the 14th Amendment, you know, it's like altogether subsection one of that's like 80 words, and the significant part is really about 20 words that have generated an incredible change in the jurisprudence of this country and of the rights enjoyed by individual citizens underneath the U.S. Constitution. So it's always scary when you're drafting, and I know it. Folks in my office worry a lot about every single time you do that this is part of the fundamental document, and each of these words is going to have to be perfect, and you're going to have to be able to explain later what you meant by the individual terms that you're using. It's a scary process, and so we're always, with the initiatives, our concern is always we see them, and you wonder if the same thought has gone into each of the terms that are used.
Representative Flores.
Thank you, and no eyes glazing over. I'd sit in your class any day for any length of time. I'd like to go back to your comments in regard to the Supreme Court as the arbiter of constitutional issues and touching on the Marbury v. Madison. In the current context, and I think that then Mr. Hendricks went on, the courts interpret the Constitution by relying on existing statute, what the drafters intended, the historical circumstances. Would you care to comment then on the current trend of the United States Supreme Court to use the European perspective and thinking in interpreting the United States Constitution?
Representative Flores? No.
Come on, that's begging the question.
The United States Supreme Court started a process about 6 years ago of looking to documents outside of the United States to cast light on the United States Constitution. and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is where this all started. Now, you can imagine the debate that is now going on at the United States Supreme Court. On the one hand, there is a faction of justices who say our sole focus is what did the drafters intend in 1787. That is a frozen document. Our goal is to go back there. We have another faction that says constitutions, like people, evolve. Words change in their meaning and understanding. And we need the best insight we can have into that evolutionary process, which makes it relevant to look outside to what is going on in the context in which the United States now acknowledges that it exists. That debate is just as ferocious as it can be, which explains 5-4 opinions very, very bitterly argued and I would say bitterly written opinions as well. That kind of debate is not going on in Oregon.
I do have another question.
Sure, you may.
Thank you. Mr. Hendricks, when you were talking about the administrative rule procedure, that does follow under the executive branch and would sometimes, some people would say, give the appearance of a legislative process. But under the Administrative Procedures Act, it is clearly not. How is it possible that some of the administrative rules that would possibly be implemented under the authority of the executive ever be intended to override or subvert the legislative process?
Representative Forrest, all of those rules are subject to judicial challenge, of course. Any person who believes that the rule that's been adopted is outside the scope and intent of the enabling legislation, which is the legal test they use, can go in and ask the court to declare that rule to be invalid. And rules are declared invalid every now and then. The most common reason being that, in fact, the rule conflicts with the statutory language. Our office reads every rule that is passed by an agency. They are required to provide us with a copy, and we look at them for that purpose as well. When we first started doing it, and this is a long time ago, I think it goes back to the 70s, we would find problems with as many as 5%, maybe 7% of the rules in the first couple of years we did it. And what's happened is, of course, agencies learn, and we're down now to about 2% or less where we find problems. But the usual problem is they adopt the rule that simply conflicts with what the statute says, and usually it's not a big deal. It may be, you know, they're authorized to provide charge certain fees, and they add another one, and we'll write a report saying, well, you know, you haven't got any statutory authority to charge that fee, et cetera. But we look at those for that purpose, and of course, anybody has the ability to go to court as well to challenge to say this is simply not what the legislature intended.
Short follow-up?
You may.
Then within your purview of looking at the administrative rules, is that something you do on an ordinary basis, or are you requested to do that, or is that part of your scope and of duty?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Forrest, we do that on a regular basis. We can't do it during session because we're busy with other things. And there is a provision, if you look in the statute, that actually indicates that any member can ask us to review a rule. So if any member comes to us and points at a rule and says, we think this one has problems, we will review it.
Thank you for that. I might ask Mr. Hendricks, doesn't the Legislative Council Committee have some, you report to it with respect to all the rules you've reviewed? I've been on that committee. I remember seeing the spreadsheets where you'd have the rules summarized and you would determine whether it was within the scope of the enabling legislation or whether it raised constitutional issues. And that's a very, very deliberative process. It goes through a legislative committee.
And it seems to us that the big fights that come up surrounding rules usually are not scope and intent issues. You know, frequently agencies do get broad grants of discretionary power. And the argument frequently is this the best rule? Now, we don't look at them to see if it's the best rule. We just look to see, do they have the authority to adopt this rule? And that's where the real battles are. But that is also supposed to be the one that takes place in the rulemaking process to decide if this is the best rule. And then, as always, the legislature can always come back later and say, you know, you can always narrow their authority. You can always come back and say, no, we don't like that rule. Pass a new law that makes it clear on this point. Again, subject to those issues about getting passage in both House and pass the veto of the governor.
Thank you. Chair Krieger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair. I have some frustration when I continue to see 5-4 decisions from the Supreme Court when they look at the same information. I kind of wonder what's driving their opinion, because it seems to be just about the same people, depending on a lot of it has to do with social issues and things of that nature. And we talk about the courts not having partisan influence or agenda or positions based on those sort of things, but it seems like it's getting worse and worse. That's just maybe as a comment. And then I look at Measure 37 that we just had passed, and the question's going to come up. I know Representative Garrard is been working on it regarding transferability and what the intent was. What would be some of the things the court would look at in determining whether that was the intent of the voters when they passed 37? Would it be hearings, land use forums, testimony, things in the voter pamphlet? Where would they look?
Representative Ackerman, Representative Krieger, first of all, the narrow fights are occurring at the United States Supreme Court. The Oregon Supreme Court issues between 97% and 98% of its opinions unanimously. And I have to say that one of the things that gives me great pride at having served on that court, and also great frustration because it is immensely time-consuming in human capital, is the long days spent around the table coming to consensus. And you have a Chief Justice who works incredibly hard to achieve that in the state of Oregon. That's not happening at the national level, I share your regret. But I think at least it demonstrates that people care passionately about constitutions. And whether a judge's job is to discern the intent of the founders or to help the document evolve according to current ethical standards is a legitimate debate. I mean, human beings are capable of disagreeing passionately about such things. We seem to have a United States Supreme Court that does so frequently and somewhat gleefully. But that's not happening in the state of Oregon. I'm going to respectfully not comment on any of the Measure 37 matters, but Dave may wish to.
Well, I think your question is what are they going to look to determine what was intended. And I think it's going to be tough because campaigns on initiatives are waged at a very high level, as you know. You know, in fact, most of the time they're drafted in such a way when they come in to basically make the big picture argument. And I think that happened with ballot measure 37. It was the big picture argument. It would be fair if government paid people for regulations that reduce the property values. And that was the way the campaign was waged. You tend not to get discussion in voters' pamphlets or anywhere else about the details of the text. I think you can probably go through all of the arguments. You're going to find almost nothing about the particular issues that are creating the biggest problems right now. And it's a bad position for the court to be in. I mean, I don't envy courts at all when they have these scenarios where they have nothing to look to, really, but they have no choice as far as making a decision. I mean, they can't just stand back and say, well, we punt, because there's nothing here to help us determine. They will do the best they can with the text. They will look long and hard to find anything to suggest what the voters may have been thinking on that particular small issue. But it's going to be tough because I think they're going to be left with the text and they're going to do the best they can with that.
Okay. I'll take other questions in a moment, but I want to figure out how much time we have left, because I think the remaining item under Roman numeral 5 will give us some ideas how to recognize these concepts with actual real cases, real situations. I'd like to get to that because I see Article 1, Section 20, 10, and 17 issues as coming up before this committee and bills I can see on the horizon. So I do want to get to that category, and it would be very, very helpful for us to talk about that. But I don't want to cut off questions from the committee, but I do want to get to the last section. Representative McPherson?
I do have one item here. To be fair, two items. But one of them is a comment and then a related question. The comment is that one cannot help but be struck when handed a copy of the U.S. and the Oregon Constitution, that the Oregon Constitution is five times as long as the U.S. Constitution. And that does suggest that perhaps it is easier than it should be to amend our fundamental document in this state. Now, that's just a comment. The question it relates to material that is in this presentation of the Constitution that I believe has been struck down as having being invalidly adopted. And I happen to be looking at Article 9, Section 10, Retirement Plan Contributions by Governmental Employees. That was, I believe, in Measure 8 from about a decade ago that was then overturned in the state police officer's case. But that material is still in the Constitution, and there's not even a footnote or explanatory material to warn the reader that it is not validly in effect. And I suspect there are other places in the Constitution where the same is true. What would it take, and I offer that up to either one of you, to clean up our Constitution, to at least get the material out of it that a person would be misled by if they pick up the document and try to read and apply it?
Chair Axelman, Representative McPherson, it's a tough issue for our office because we do get these questions about how decisions are made about what remains in and what goes out when there has been a case that's come down. Sometimes the issue is simply that it's not quite clear it's completely dead. As you know, sometimes there are some qualifications. I think maybe on the retirement contribution ones where they declared it void, perhaps there was a better argument on that. But there are several things in here that have been struck down over time that should go away, in my opinion. There's one that always confused me about the ability of cities and counties to regulate the sale of alcoholic beverages. And I read that and I go, how come nobody's using it? I've never heard anything about it. And it's got this long history involved where because when Prohibition came in, it was impliedly repealed. And then when Prohibition went away, it was not impliedly revived. So it's a dead letter. It doesn't have any meaning. These are the sort of things that someday it would seem to me a revision would be handy to do. I always wanted to get rid of the old Article 7. One of the reasons the Constitution's a little longer than it is because we got two Article 7s in there, and there's a long history on those as well. The problem is, of course, whenever you start saying we're going to do a constitutional revision, everybody gets excited. I mean, we tried it back. I think it was in the late 50s, early 60s, the legislature set up a Constitution Revision Commission, or committee, I can't remember which it was. And they worked long and hard, and they indeed produced a draft of a revised Constitution that was intended to update it and get rid of the weird stuff and get rid of, at that time, a lot of the racist stuff that crept in to the Constitution in 1857.
Crept in.
Well, that's part of the argument about whether or not you stay with the original drafters' intent. Yeah. A lot of the original drafters were flat-out racist, or...
We came very close to having racial slavery in this state. We have wording that is so racist, especially involving Chinese and Japanese, it's incredible. But yeah, that gets back to the problem: is it our goal in an interpretation to go with the original intent or with the evolution? I had a thought though, as you two were talking, in this document that we handed out comes out of the Oregon Revised Statutes. It's been photocopied from there. In the annotated versions of the statutes, we know what judicial interpretations have done. Would there be anything wrong with, parenthetically, when the Oregon Supreme Court has declared a provision invalid, so noting so that a reader is on alert, that short of a constitutional convention?
Yeah, we have started doing a little bit of that already. If you look on page, I got to find it here quick. When we had the Armada case come down and we had to decide what to do with the original measure that had passed, if you look on page 10 up in the upper left-hand corner, we actually do have a note that mentions that Armada came down and we have taken out the original measure 40 and we have substituted the four provisions that were adopted afterwards when they were separately submitted. So it's something we look at from time to time. It's sometimes a hard decision to make, though, about whether we can simply just pull it out. Because once we do...
I'll just put in a parenthetical note is all I was suggesting.
And then someday, I think a cleanup would be in order. It's just the political aspects of, as I was saying, they tried to do it in the early 60s. There was actually a revised constitution submitted to the voters in 1970. It was defeated about 100,000, 180. I don't know why exactly it went down. I think it did get into some of the fundamental provisions, though. It was not a restrained revision. It was one that really wanted to make changes, and the voters weren't ready to go there at that point. But someday a cleanup one would be a nice thing to do, it seems to me. A consensus one, perhaps.
Okay, further questions before we go on to the... Yes?
One very quick one, I promise.
Yes, just take a minute.
Thank you. I would like to go back to the administrative rule process. Now, when an administrative rule is implemented, but it is not implemented within the time frame stated on the effective date of a statute that is passed, a lot of that. Is there any provision for spanking somebody on that one?
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, whenever we write a statute in which we say agency do this, and sometimes we'll say agency do this on or before a certain date, and it might be adopt the rule on or before a certain date, we don't have a general provision that says, and if you don't, you go to jail or you get a fine or something like that. There are remedies, though, and the remedies are a judicial remedy called mandamus, which is the ability to go into court and get a court to say to an agency, look, there's a statute that says you shall do this. By George, you shall do it. So there are remedies. It's just that for timing things, it's difficult because, they may still, the delay may be bad enough. But I don't know of a good solution on that for how you force an agency to do something within a certain time frame other than mandamus.
Quick follow-up or comment.
Sure.
And then would it be the responsibility of legislative council in order to, if there's an effective date of a bill, of a law that is passed by the House and the Senate and signed by the governor, that effective date is not extensive enough to include the time frame for creating administrative rules. Maybe it would be back on the onus of the legislative council's office not to include an effective date that is clearly outside real time doability.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, rules, are complicated in that respect because agencies can adopt rules almost immediately on an emergency basis. There is a long process, of course, that takes months to get a permanent rule. But if you want to get one in effect quick for 6 months, there is that mechanism to declare an emergency and do it immediately. So usually our office wouldn't look at it and say, oh, there's a big time problem here simply because they have the ability to do it. It's just the political, sometimes it's the political issues about what the rule is going to say that really holds it up, not the inability to get one done fast.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? I think I might add just a question to some of Representative Flores' questions. At first, before we could get to the interpreter rules, isn't it correct that the agency must be given legislative authorization to enact rules? And also, if they have that authority, they have the authority to limit the rulemaking power of the subject agency. Would that be correct?
That is correct. You have the ability to give them authority, and you have the ability to take it away. The legislature does.
Thank you. Let's go on to the last section because I think I recognize issues, and I'd like to know if you could relate as to a few cases or fact patterns that we should look to in interpreting these Article 1 situations.
That's mine, Article 1, Section 20. That one's a tough one, and the reason I kind of thought it would be a good one to talk about was because it kind of illustrates the fact that even some of the provisions of the Constitution that have been in there since 1857 still don't have very clear rules with respect to how they're interpreted. You would think Article 1, Section 20, which is fairly fundamental, would by now be pretty much of a dead letter as far as what it means and how it operates. And I should say Article 1, Section 20 is the provision that says that you know, privileges, and I'll read it so I don't get it wrong. It says, no law shall be passed granting to any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not equally belong to all citizens. One of the most recent cases we had on this particular provision came down from the Court of Appeals, in which the Court of Appeals said, we do not pretend that the cases construing Article 1, Section 20 describe a completed, coherent jurisprudence. It is perhaps best to view the cases at this juncture as something of a work in progress. So there's the problem. It's not something, it's like many provisions of the Constitution, it continues to evolve. So I can tell you kind of basically where the Supreme Court has kind of left us with that caveat that I think it is well is a work in progress, and we may find out from some recent cases that they may want to relook at some of these earlier decisions. What Article 1, Section 20 does in the interpretation up till now is basically say, address the question of where the legislature can draw lines. We all have learned since the 60s that discrimination is a bad thing, but as a practical matter, the legislature discriminates between people all the time. In fact, you might even regard the process of making law as basically the job of figuring out who qualifies and who doesn't. You know, tax laws are a great example. You know, if you have household income of more than $20,000, you don't get this. If you have less, you have more. Well, if my household income is $20,100, where's the fairness in me not getting this benefit and the person with $19,800 household income getting it? And how does the court decide whether or not that is something that the Constitution steps in and says, no, you can't do that? Since legislation drawing lines is so common, and we do it so much in this building, it's obvious that the court couldn't have a test that was too strict, or they would be striking down a huge number of laws every session based on the fact that you drew this line here, and some people fall below, and some people fall above. You know, there are many examples, statute of limitations, you know, gee, I got my claim in a day too late. Just so many of the things we do, in fact, basically divide people into classes and say, if you meet this qualification, you get the benefit. If you don't, you do not. But the court has said that, in general, that for most of those, what they're going to look at and say, it's okay as long as there's basically some rational basis for drawing the line. And it's an extremely low standard that they have used for most of the cases that have come down. In fact, I always look at Article 1, Section 20 as the constitutional argument you throw into your case, you know, as a last thing, knowing that probably you're not going to get anywhere with it. And if you look at the annotations, there's lots and lots of cases on this constitutional provisions, but there's not very many where people have won on it, where people have come in and actually managed to succeed on this argument. The big exceptions, of course, to the general rule is if you're talking about what the U.S. Supreme Court talks about as suspect classifications. Obviously, if you're talking about a law that distinguishes between people on certain immutable innate characteristics such as race, sex, national origin, things like that, both the U.S. and the Oregon courts have looked at those, of course, with great suspicion, because at that point, it's not just a classification that's been created by the law itself. And that's where the Oregon courts have gone. I think Judge Leeson will agree, this is one of those cases where the Oregon courts, even though they've got radically different language in the Oregon Constitution about how they talk about this as far as privileges, immunities versus equal protection in the U.S. Constitution, they've kind of followed along with the analysis that the U.S. Supreme Court has used on the equal protection one as far as how they look at these laws in these cases. And they've looked at suspect classification and said, we're going to give high scrutiny to any law that purports to distinguish between people based on these immutable inner characteristics they have no control over, some race, national origin, sex, etc. And those do get struck down. In fact, if you ask us to draft the law, and if we see any word in there that says anything about race, about sex, about religion, et cetera, you know, our eyebrows go up because, you know, our antennas go up and we're going, is there any way you can even do this? Because any law that gets into that, unless it's something that's really tied in to the essence, you can write a bill, for instance, about sex, as long as, in fact, for instance, women's health bills do not raise that problem because they are issues that are of significance only to women. And so those tend to look at them and say, that's fine. Even though it may talk about women in it, that's okay. But almost all the other bills where if you talk about women, it's going to raise these flags. So you have those categories. In Oregon, what they said, the first thing they're going to do is see if the class that's created arises solely out of the law itself. So, for instance, the tax law says if you are have household income of less than $20,000, I think the Oregon courts would look at that and say there is no natural class out there of people, of households that have less than $20,000. I mean, the only reason that category exists is because the law itself created it. And the courts would say if this is the only reason the class exists is because the statute is written, there's no analysis at all. That's it. The game's over. Those laws are automatically fine. They don't even do a rational basis look at that one. They just say no class. There is no classification created. If, in fact, it is a true characteristic of it, people, and these get harder because it gets harder to define who these classes are. Real classes that exist out there, I have great difficulty figuring out this part of the analysis because it's people, true classifications, and the one I always cite is the one from the principal case, it's State v. Clark, in which Justice DeWitt, I think it was, had a footnote. She said, well, let's think about what some of these true classes are, but that we wouldn't, would not find to be rational versus irrational. And the one he gives is like people with a certain hair color. Got brown hair, or you can change hair. Let's use eye color. Harder to change eye color. Blue eyes. We're going to pass a law that only applies to blue eyes. It's hard to imagine any law that would have a rational reason for distinguishing between a class of people who have blue eyes versus eyes of a different color. And so that's probably the type of totally irrational law with a true class where the court might strike it down. Otherwise, most of those laws are probably going to survive. Now, I'm not sure which types of bills you might have coming up in front of you that might raise these questions, but those are the type of analysis that the court has developed basically on privileges and immunities and might very well be looking at it again as they go through some of the cases they've currently got in front of them.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I answer the question?
Yes, President Ford.
Then Mr. Hendricks, as we're talking about a classification race, you used sex. Now you're talking about gender. You're not talking about sexual orientation. Is that correct?
He doesn't know yet.
We don't know. This is
hence the hedge. Okay.
I wasn't even going to say it. The Chair Ackerman, Representative Forrest. Right now we have one case called Tanner versus OHSU. It's a Court of Appeals case. It did not go up to the Supreme Court. It found sexual orientation to be a true class and a protected class. Not a protected, I guess I should say, a true class. And they did, basically, as I understand, rereading the case, a rational basis analysis and said we could find no rational basis in laws that provided state benefits to people where they distinguish between same-sex couples. And that is the rule that state agencies have been living under since that case came down in 1998, because until the Supreme Court finally makes a decision about this, we don't know.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions on Article 1, Section 20? Let's go to Article 1, Section 10.
This is also my little bit. Now, Article 1, Section 10 is one of those provisions that kind of worked there forever and nobody utilized it. I mean, there are almost no cases on this going back, and to the extent they were, the court said it doesn't mean very much. And if you look at it, I think you already had it kind of quoted to you. It's on page 5 of the Oregon Constitution. The crucial piece is it says, every man shall have a remedy by due process of law for injury done him in his injury, his person, property, or reputation. A little sexism there built in there.
Due course of law.
due course of law for injury done him in his person, property, or reputation. That, as Justice Leeson has already pointed out, there is no equivalent provision in the federal constitution. The federal constitution has a provision, of course, in the 14th Amendment that talks about due process of the law, which has got a huge amount of jurisprudence surrounding it relating to what that means, and has one of the most interesting histories when you do research of constitutional law of what can happen with the provision of the U.S. Supreme Court over time. Where it's at right now in the federal constitution is basically a requirement of fairness in proceedings and fairness in the way the state treats citizens. A requirement that, in fact, if you're going to take away a benefit, for instance, that there's an opportunity to be heard that whether or not you should actually lose that benefit. Section 10 has never been interpreted that way. It's never been interpreted to provide even the requirement of fairness in a proceeding. And if you read it, the interesting question is, can it really even mean what it says? If you just read it, it seems to suggest that you shall have a remedy for every injury done to you. Well, depending on what it means to say a remedy by due course of law, as I mentioned in the tort claim, you know, there are lots of bad things in my tort presentation. There are lots of bad things that happen to you in life for which there is no remedy. I mean, life isn't fair. Bad things happen. Certainly this thing can't mean that every citizen in the state of Oregon has the right to some remedy just because for everything that happens to them that is they want to argue is a wrong or an injury to them, that I should have some remedy to recover that. But what the courts have done is picked up on this because of the arguments being made for the first time in looking at this in respect to laws passed by the legislature, limiting rent, for instance, limiting damages, and saying in conjunction with Article 1, Section 17, the right to jury trial, that there are limits on the ability of the legislature to, in fact, take what were rights available in 1857 when the Constitution was passed and reduce the availability of those remedies. And there was one long string of cases from the Supreme Court that I think ran through the 40s, 50s that used to say the legislature, for instance, could abolish a cause of action, that was okay. Abolishing a cause of action was okay. The most recent case that came down on it said, no, backing away from that, it's not okay to abolish a cause of action because you're eliminating a remedy that was available in 1857. And this is part of the court's evolving emphasis on looking back, I think, to what the drafters perceived they were doing in 1857 and putting this provision in, and putting in Article 1, Section 17, which talks about jury trial in civil cases, about what they were trying to protect. And what the courts read this based on a lot of historical analysis. When you read these cases, they look more like history essays than they do, traditional legal analysis as they go back and try to find sources to tell them what the intent was. They are looking at these types of provisions and saying they intended to basically protect some of these remedies that were available through the courts. Article 1, Section 17 was another one of those that just never had much jurisprudence on it because in all cases the right of jury, trial by jury, shall be remain inviolate, civil cases. Well, nobody looked at that very close because there's another provision in Article 7, the new one, Section 3, which came along by initiative amendment in 1910 and basically kind of qualified that.
Page 26.
There we go, on page 28.
Is that right?
Uh-oh, I'm looking at...
I have a different version.
Where it says, in actions at law with a value in controversy shall exceed $750, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. So most of the analysis was looking at that. It said, well, yeah, you've got a right to jury trial in civil cases, but only if there's at least $750 at stake. If there's less than that, you don't have a right to jury trial. And so Article 1, Section 17 was pretty much ignored. So how did this get in front of the Oregon Supreme Court? As we've already mentioned, most of these provisions come from other constitutions. And what had happened was in other states where there had been laws passed limiting the right to acquire damages, the same arguments were being made under those constitutions about the right to jury trial under this section. Washington had already decided this issue many years ago. And finally, someone came in and made the argument before the Oregon Supreme Court and said, we think the right to jury trial encompasses the right, for instance, to get all damages awarded by the jury. And the Supreme Court at that time did the historical analysis and came to that conclusion. So, again, two sections that have not had a lot of use up until about 10 or 15 years ago and now are kind of front and center. And it's an evolving analysis that I look at these cases, and I'm not sure where they're at yet as far as how far they're going to go with this analysis. And it's going to be a case-by-case decision, I think, as things come forward.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? I had just one, and because as I look ahead, I can sort of see some bills coming down that might raise this question. And I know that I've considered similar bills in other sessions. And that's where a person or group seeks immunity from civil claims for their actions. It seems to me that raises an Article 1, Section 10 issue. Is that correct?
It certainly does, Representative Ackerman. I think both plaintiff and defense attorneys have been watching the Supreme Court carefully to see when they get their next case up in which they look at one of these statutes, and there are hundreds of them, at least a couple hundred, I think, maybe not hundreds and hundreds, but at least a couple hundred, if not 300, statutes where the law simply says someone is immune from liability. They cannot be sued for doing something. And the question is, based on the previous cases that the Oregon Supreme Court has handed down, are those laws valid? And I think there's some substantial question, but we don't know the answer yet. And to some degree, it's going to depend on the particular facts of the case and the what's being claimed. I think we talked a little bit in the torts presentation about some of the exceptions that have already been made. For instance, on punitive damages, they've already had that case, and they said, oh, you can do whatever you want with punitive damages because punitive damages are different than compensatory damages. You may not have gotten there just by doing your own analysis, but that's where the Supreme Court ended up, and we're going to have to look at it. But certainly that question is there.
Okay, further questions from the committee? Looking both ways, I see none. Any concluding remarks from the panel?
Thank you
very much for your presentation.
Thank you. Careful thinking.
It's very helpful to this committee to have this level of discussion with us as we anticipate further work of the committee. So thank you very, very much. Further business of the subcommittee? Seeing none, we're adjourned.
We're going to full for just a minute.
We're going to go to full? Okay.